Om Jnanatimirandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Dhena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Narayanam Namaskritya Naram Chaiva Narottamam Devim Sarasatim Vyasam Tato Jaya Mudiraya. Those parrots? I like the birds. Pretty nice. And since there's no clock today on the wall, we'll go all day. I'm so happy to be back, and thank you all for being here. I think when I come here that I've entered the spiritual world. Wherever else I go, I'm absorbed and delighted. But when I come here, I'm home, and all of you are my life and soul. So just seeing you all here brings my life back to me. And thank you for thank you for giving your heart and soul to the movement of Srila Prabhupada and Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, because it makes much more of a difference than you even know, even amidst the daily struggles as you continue with your vows and with also nonviolence, which is held at a very high standard by Srila Prabhupada, which means that you actually have to be actively engaged in giving others Krishna conscious to be considered nonviolent. It doesn't just mean wearing a mask or drinking Himsa milk. It means that you actually have to go out and give people knowledge one by one and in mass and in whatever way you can in order to be qualified as nonviolent. So you're all doing that and making a huge difference in the world. So thank you very much for letting me come back. Hare Krishna. And the best of all musicians, wherever I go, nobody can compare to the mandanga, the kartal playing, and the harmonium playing. I always feel like, hey, what happened? I come back here, it's like, oh. And also, I'm happy to be here and sitting in a Bhagavatam class, because while we were Govardhan, that's mostly what we were doing. And it's safest in life to be on a schedule where you're fully engaged, because the material world is a very precarious place. Actually, know it or not, we're hanging by a thread here. And there's the legend of Damocles and the sword of Damocles that hangs over the head by a thread, and that is hanging over all of us, not the least of which is because of our relationship with the material energy, which has been long and sordid, and because of that, at any moment it can be revived, and therefore safest thing while we have the opportunity over approximately 84 years, which is what the insurance companies say most humans live. Women live a little longer, but don't take advantage of it. We have to use as much of that as possible in the direct devotional service of the Lord, specifically hearing and chanting. Hearing the Bhagavatam is especially recommended. And coming back from Vrindavan, where we over the last month read the 5th, 6th, and 7th cantos together, about 5 hours a day, my conclusion was that the deeper you dive into the Bhagavatam, the deeper you see it is. And in one sense, it's a little frustrating, because the materialistic mind wants to control everything and say, now I've got it. I understand Bhagavatam. I can recite Bhagavatam. I know Bhagavatam. But as we go into it, we see that, oh, I don't know anything. I'm tiny. It's Krishna. And Krishna is unlimited. And if we could circumscribe the Bhagavatam by our intelligence, then it wouldn't be Krishna, nor would Krishna be Krishna if we could do that, because Krishna means that he's unlimited and that there's not a point at which we can completely understand, and we can't even understand material nature. I mean, if we were to say that to whatever degree we understand material nature in any of its aspects, any of the sciences as an example, you'd have to say, you'd put a dot and then 10 miles worth of zeros and then a one or whatever number you want to put to say that that's how much we actually know about any given subject matter, even in material nature. Cell biology, oceanography, I mean, they say, oceanographers, at least I heard this, that they only have cataloged 10% of the life in the ocean. So there is still hope of seeing a Timangila fish sometime. And how they know that it's 10%, that's probably impious. Which leaves us to understand what the Bhagavad Gita tells us in the Srimad Bhagavatam, is that we really are tiny parts of the Supreme Personality of God, who is unlimited. And our real happiness comes through recognizing that and surrendering to him and entering into the internal potency and learning the different categories of truths. What are tattvas? I mean, tattva, the word tat means that. It's a way of speaking that in the Vedic language simplifies things. They try to use as few words as possible to describe the most information. When we say Om Tat Sat, for instance, as we see in the 17th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Tat means that. And we're pointing to Om Tad Vishnu Param Sada. We're pointing to that supreme abode and the lotus feet of the Personality of God, from which that abode emanates, as does everything. And va is like a tattva, means thatness. So what are we to understand? We're to understand those things that actually exist, and there are various categories that exist according to the Vishnu Purana of truth. Of one of those truths is the internal potency, the other is the external potency, and the other is the marginal potency, of which we are a part. And to understand those three truths and to understand our relationship with the internal and external potency is the essence of Sambandha Gyan, which is absolutely necessary for one to be a properly functioning living entity. Otherwise, we get mixed up and we take part in the external energy and think that we're living an actual life, but we're not. I saw on the way through the airport an advertisement for a movie, and it said, based on a true story. And I was thinking, this whole material world is based on a true story. It's like a film, but it's like, you know, if you see a movie that's based on a true story, so which part's true, which one's not? It's like, there's a real story somewhere else. This is kind of like the embellishment, or it's a fake, it's a replica. This is a replica. It's based on a true story. Everything you see here is it's verisimilitude. There's an idea that it's similar, but it's just similar. It's not the real thing. It's real in a sense, but it's temporary. That's the material energy. And if I get tricked into thinking this is the real story and my story is the big thing, I'll be disappointed. When the loved ones die, for instance, I'm bewildered of what happened. Bhagavatam's very direct and says, this is what happened. They're not actually your relatives. It tells the story of King Chitraketu, who wanted to have a son, had a son, lost the son in very unfortunate circumstances. And then Narada and Angira revealed that the son was actually just a living entity. Living entities brought back into his little baby body. They ask him, why'd you leave your father and mother? And he said, I don't really recognize them. That's the truth of it, the material world. It's based on a true story. We do have a father and mother, but this is not them. They're only replicas. It's an act. It's a play. So To have that kind of information from the Srimad Bhagavatam and the Bhagavad Gita is the most valuable of all information. In fact, it's the only thing that is valuable. And the world's going on as if everything's fine. But it's really not. I mean, the whole acceptance of a consumer society where Black Friday is celebrated as we'll call it Black Saturday because yesterday didn't count. But that's something actually viable, that it's to be celebrated or appreciated or something like that. It shows how far human beings have come from understanding reality. So the fact that we have the service to interject, or as Prabhupada would say, inject within human society this valuable knowledge as people are out looking for some object that will make them happy, or they'll make somebody else happy, or that they'll become happy by presenting it to them even if the other person isn't happy. There's all kinds of various people thinking about buying things at this time of year. But when they actually get a hold of a Bhagavad Gita or a Srimad Bhagavatam, then they've got their hands on something substantial, on tat, on a category which is real. And they can read about the real story. No one else is going to tell them. They can subscribe to the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, and they won't read about it anywhere. There'll be a mixture of information that's tainted with the lower modes of material nature, and it will never satisfy their sense of a being, living entities. Whereas a couple of verses, one verse from the Bhagavad Gita can awaken somebody to their real purpose in life and reorient them in hearing the holy name. Actually, this is one of the glorifications that is given by the acharyas and in the Bhagavatam itself, that the holy name is a little bit proactive, forceful actually, that he comes to the material world, and whether people like it or not, he enters into their ears. And the book they can take or not take, when they do take it, it amplifies the holy name because it goes off and it'll continue radiating for years, generations, and so forth, and affect people in a very profound way. Whole villages, whole countries can be affected by one book. And the holy name, it doesn't wait for somebody to acquiesce. It simply enters their ears. And when it does, even if they don't believe in it, the sixth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, the story of Ajamil, Shukadev Goswami said, it's just like medicine that's potent. Whether you believe it works or it doesn't work, it's still going to act because it has that property. So similarly, the holy name, when we go today to chant in San Francisco, will have its effect. And even if people cover their ears, I mean, that might even make it worse. Just like when the demons, they try to avoid Krishna, they think of him more. So when people, it's like, stop chanting Hare Krishna. It's like, oh my God, you just said it. It has its effect. So at the same time, we also are sensitive to the fact that people have a frame of reference, that they are the body, that this is an important activity that they're doing, going shopping and so forth. And we honor that because we are moving about the world, and our purpose is to give Krishna consciousness, and recognizing the fact that when somebody is administering some kind of medicine, and we have to take very serious our role in doing that as messengers, we also have to have a bedside manner so that the medicine can be accepted, and therefore we have to treat people with the utmost kindness and compassion and respect, even if they are not interested or they're averse. We give them a clear path so that they're not agitated more, and we leave each person that we meet with a good impression. Gopamanande Haribol. So, from the Srimad Bhagavatam, the seventh canto, there's a very important theme that unfolds. And again, I'm going to have to look at my watch. So we're ending at 9 today, so we can go downtown San Francisco, where we have our new Bhakti Center West. The Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 7, opens with a conversation between Parikshit Maharaj and Shukadeva Goswami. It's continuing from the sixth canto, in which we hear about the conflicts between the demigods and the demons, and they are considerable. In fact, this goes on everywhere in the universe. There's good guys and bad guys. At Bhagavad Gita 16 chapter, Krishna confirms that there are people with demoniac nature and there are people with divine nature. And they're at odds with one another. So get used to it. That's the material world. It's not that things are going to even out here and everything will be peaceful. In fact, it's pointed out in the seventh canto, the Srimad Bhagavatam, that there are upheavals even in the upper planetary systems. In fact, I was thinking, I wrote something in my notebook about a thought I had for a paper or a small book called Happy in Hell. That'd be a nice tract. A little tract, you know. The other religious groups, they give out tracts, and ours could be called Happy in Hell. How is that? You know, it's expressed in the sixth canto of the Bhagavatam, Narayana Paraksarve Nakutashana Bhibhyati Swarga Pavarga Narakeshu Api Tulyarta Darshina. This comes when Parvati had cursed Chitraketu because she had thought that he made an offense to Lord Shiva. Shiva didn't take it seriously. It was just joking amongst peers, pure devotees. Parvati, doing her duty as a good wife, she sort of stepped forward and said, "Who do you think you are?" laughing at my husband, and said, "You know, you should become a demon in your next life." So Chitraketu took it on his head. He said, "Thank you very much. I appreciate my all respects to you, and I accept your curse with great honor because it's coming from you." And Shiva said, "Just see how the devotees are equal. Apitulyarta darshina. They're equal. They see everything equally, whether they're in heaven or whether they're in hell." But the Bhagavatam goes on in the fifth canto, going back a little bit, that there are gradations of happiness in the material world. And there are neighborhoods you can live in. The upper planetary systems, you live for a lot longer time. There are fewer disturbances than in the middle and lower planetary systems. Little suffering at all, if any, in the upper planetary systems. Although, as I mentioned, they're not immune. Abhana Bhuvanaloka Punar Avartino Arjuna Mamupeja, etc. Krishna says, from topmost planet down to the lowest. So in the upper planetary system, throughout the Bhagavatam we hear, especially in fifth canto and the 11th, that the residents there who are intelligent, the demigods and so forth, pray that they could take birth in Jambudvip and Bhumandala, especially in the earthly middle planetary system, because there's a greater opportunity for becoming God conscious. Why? Because in the heavenly planets, they say everything's so nice that there's no real impetus to become Krishna conscious. If you're given a credit card today, any of you who are worried about debt, paying the mortgage on your house or your car or anything like that, and somebody gives you a credit card, you don't have to pay it back. It's got $11 trillion of credit. You might relax a little bit, right? Why work so hard? I don't have to go to work today. I got an $11 trillion credit card. Similarly, if we're given an advantageous position materially, then the mind immediately relaxes and thinks, like, I'm okay. So Kunti said this, that I prefer it when I'm under stress and in a situation of duress, because then I think of you more. So similarly, demigods, those who are sincere about advancing spiritually, say, it's too nice here. Even more so in the subterranean hellish planets, Bula Svarga. There is a situation in some areas, it's actually the worst, but it's the best materially. It's better than heaven. And why is that so bad? Because it's so good there, they never have to think of God, ever. They never have to pray. They just think everything's fine. And this is the worst of all situations, according to Shukadev Goswami, because you're in complete ignorance. What is that complete ignorance? I'm fine. Everything's taken care of. Conclusion of those who are advanced spiritually, middle planetary systems are good. There's not so much heavenly happiness, except in California a little bit, but there's enough distress and suffering that to remind us constantly nowadays that I got to get out of here. The house is burning, literally. So we should be happy in hell. When hellish conditions come to us, be happy that it's hell. And to recognize the fact that this is a position, a situation that's given to us just so that we can advance spiritually. And this is the quintessential attitude that a sincere practitioner of bhakti develops. Tate anukampam susamikshamano bunjana evatmakritam vipakam. That whatever vipakam, whatever boiling that's taking place here, however I'm being cooked here in the material world, kumbipaka, that's Krishna's mercy. So they want to get out of the pot, jump out and go back to Godhead. So we take advantage of that. So now, after the sixth canto, we've heard about the various upheavals, the fights between the demigods and the demons in the upper planetary systems. And Krishna helps out the demigods. So now Shukadev Goswami is explaining to Parikshit Maharaj, who wanted to know, that seems a little odd because it's well known that Krishna is supposed to be equal to everybody. So how is it that he helped out the demigods and didn't help the demons so much? So then this whole question of equality is discussed here in the beginning of the Srimad Bhagavatam. In essence, the answer to that is that actually we have independence as living entities. And we put ourselves in advantageous or disadvantageous situations due to our developed temperament. And our situation in the material world is due to our own choice. Purusha prakriti stohi bhunti prakriti jan gunan kananam guna sangosya sarasad yoni janmasu. Krishna says in the Gita, 13th chapter, 20th verse, that whatever we have now, it's because of our association previously. And we've developed ourselves in a certain way that we have attracted various modes of material nature. So Shukadev Goswami explains that according to the modes that we've developed, we will attract us the mercy of the Lord or we will repel it. And when one is trending towards the mode of goodness, one is able to absorb more of the mercy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And when one is in the lower modes of material nature, one becomes repellent, that one repels the mercy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So it only appears that he's given one person more mercy and another person less, but it's due to their own capacity to take it in. How's the temperature in here? It's kind of muggy. It's mushi atsui, as they say in Japan, like muggy. Anything we can do, or is it all broken? Decrease the temperature. Unless you want to meditate on Juhu, Bombay, or something like that. I was just waiting for the elevator there last year. I almost died. It was only about 10 seconds. I mean, it's hot and muggy there like anything. So if you want to, we can meditate on that we're in Mumbai. But you can tell it's muggy because the mudungas don't work in this weather so well. This one I had to grab on the way out because all the other ones were totally flat. It's the only one that worked. So, in the Gita, Krishna talks about this quality of sameness or seeing things equally. Because Krishna does. Krishna sees things equally, and he's equal to everyone. Samaham sarvabhuteshu name dveshosti napriyaha. So there's a couple of Bhagavad Gita verses that we can look at. And as we do, we can remember, before we go out to distribute Krishna consciousness to the people of San Francisco, to see everyone equally. First of all, in the fifth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, the most famous verse about sameness and about how a learned person sees everyone the same is Amapam Yaya Sarvatra, that's from the sixth chapter, right? So from the fifth chapter, I'm thinking the famous verse that His Holiness Radhanath Maharaj quotes more than any other verse. Vijaminai Sambhane Ramani Gavi Hastini Shuni Chai Vastupakecha Pandita Samadarshina. Very interesting. This is a verse in which Krishna says, who is the most learned? And he claims here that the person who is able to have equal vision of all living entities as the most learned of persons. Now, interestingly, he points out all the differences first. Because he says, Vidya Vinaya Sambhane Brahmani Gavi Hastini. So now he's naming, first of all, the highest in society, the Vedic society, is the learned Brahmana. And not just the priest who, you know, rings a bell or something like that for money, but the person who actually has all the brahminical qualities, qualified Brahmana. Brahmani, Gavi. Gavi means? So then there's the cow. So first he names the Brahmana, then the cow. Brahmani, Gavi, Hastini, then the Hasti. Hasti means hand. So elephant is has a hand. The trunk is like a hand because it grabs stuff, so they're called Hastis. And so you got Brahmani, Gavi, Hastini, Shuni, there's a dog. And then you come to this next thing, Shuni, Chaiva, Shopake. Shopake actually means a dog cooker. So over Thanksgiving, you know, people are home, and you can judge a person by what they eat, according to the Vedic culture. And it's like, what do you eat? What do you have for Thanksgiving? That's all you have to ask. And he's like, okay, I understand. Someone, you know, you meet someone today, it was all vegan. And then you'll know they're in a certain consciousness. Like somebody else is like, we had a turkey. It's like, poor bird, you know. Then somebody else is like, we ate our dog. Then you're like, okay, I understand where you're coming from. The Shuni Chaiva Shopake is a dog cooker. It's like, you cooked a dog? Okay. That's we're working with here. So these differences are something that he points out, but how are they the same? Externally, no one's the same. In fact, if you look in the United States Constitution, we find that it's based on a metaphysical principle that everybody's the same. We hold these truths, says Thomas Jefferson, who wrote these lines, to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. So if there's a Brahmani, Gavi, Hastini, Shuni, and Shopake, how are they equal? How is the Shopake equal to the Brahmani? Well, they're not, externally. There's no comparison. In fact, if you compare anybody in this world based on their qualifications materially, you won't find that anybody's the same. So, in the Bhagavad Gita or in the Constitution of the United States, how does it make sense? There's only one way that makes sense, and it's based on a higher truth, which is something that we all hold as self-evident. When it comes down to it, we all hold as self-evident that there's a higher truth beyond the differences in the material world, that we're all the same. And we'll find this It's a pervasive idea that people want equality everywhere. However, because they don't have sufficient knowledge to understand where that equality exists, they try to claim it on the material level. Let everybody be equal. But that's not going to happen. Because the modes of material nature jumble everything up, and externally, nobody's on an equal level. Everyone has some superiority or inferiority based on the combination of modes of nature that their psychophysiological nature is made up of. So what's the equal part? Well, Krishna mentions it here. Brahmadigali Hastini Shuni Chaiva Shupakicha Pandita Samadarshina. He sees that they're all spiritually on the same level, because they all come from the original origin, Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And we'll note in the Bhagavatam, 5th chapter, 1st canto, when Narada Muni describes how he's becoming enlightened by the association of sadhus, he says, I realize that I and the Lord are on the same level qualitatively, not quantitatively. Qualitatively, I realize I'm in the same category. I'm spiritual, just like he is, eternal. And so having this vision is what Krishna says is the learned situation of the human being. So this is how we're all equal. And that requires a little thought. Equality is there, but how are you going to find that equality? Where do you find that equality? That's what Bhagavad Gita is teaching. That's what we're distributing today. That's the missing piece that everybody's looking for. Americans, bless their hearts, they're pious people. It's based on a document, an idea, concept that is we're all meant to be united. We're all meant to be equal. We're all meant to work together in harmony. It doesn't work on the material level. And therefore people are suffering. But if we add Bhagavad Gita to the already strong impetus that the people of America have to find this equality, then we're doing the greatest service in the world. We're giving them that missing link. They have powerful technology that's missing a part, one part. And if we give them that part, the whole thing will work properly. And they'll be happy. The Constitution of the United States will make sense to them. It will be fully functional when they get this one little part. It's a little yellow, orange-yellow kind of a chip. You can think of the books today that we're distributing. 1,000 little chips that will fit inside the machine that they have that is now lacking. And once that chip goes in, the whole machine will work properly for them. Their hardware, the software will all come together based on that. So, because we're almost out of time, a couple more thoughts. This equality, Krishna says in the second chapter, 48th verse, Samatvam Yoga Uchite. He said, this is yoga. So to be equal, to see this equality everywhere, and this is what is called yoga. Yogastha kuru karmani. So yogastha means equipoised, means that one's situated in yoga. Kuru, perform, karmani, your duties. So it's a very active thing. Sangam chakva. So you're doing your work, but you're not attached to it. Dhananjaya. Siddhi asiddho. So whether it comes out the way you wanted it to or it didn't, it's a siddhi asiddho. Sama bhutva. Samatam yoga uchite. So you remain equal, whether it works or doesn't work. And then he says this yoga, samatvam yoga uchite. This is called yoga, to be equal. Whether it's perfect or it's not perfect, you did your duty according to the authority, and if it worked out, fine. If it didn't work out, okay? You remain equal in both situations. So this is called yoga, Krishna says. We'll find this theme throughout the Bhagavad Gita, that one has to attain this sense of equality and balance. Equality is a constant theme. So next verse, 519. Almost ready for reflections. Jitta Sargo. So now Krishna talks in the 519 about how our minds have to be samye. Ihaiva ter jitta sargo, please repeat. Isham samye stitam manaha. Nirdosham hisamam brahma. Tasmad brahmani te stitaha. So, iha means in this life. And eva, certainly tied by them. Jitta means conquered. Sarga, birth and death. Now listen to this. A person who is equal, samye, in the material world, is considered to be liberated. They've actually conquered sarga. This sarga means the material world, which is in constant upheaval. There's always some kind of destruction going on here. These are described in the Tattvasandarbha and elsewhere, and even in the 8th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, how the material world is constantly being destroyed and recreated. And the body itself is a universe. It's constantly being destroyed and created. In fact, take a breath. Take one more breath. You didn't breathe into the same body the second time. It's a different body. It's constantly changing. It's not that it's growing. It's not that it's stretching and becoming, you know, a bigger body. It's changing constantly like a river. So we're in an environment of sarga. It's constantly being destroyed, recreated. And this is disturbing to us living entities because we're eternal. We're not used to a temporary environment, nor do we thrive in such an environment, do we? Or do you all like it? Three people don't. The rest of you like it, I guess. No, okay. No. So, jitta sargo, if you're able to become samye, amidst the changes, you're equal, equally situated, a samye stitam, and your mind doesn't change, despite the changes of the material world, and despite seeing the differences in the material world, then he says, nirdosham, you're flawless. Who else is flawless? Brahman, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Brahman is flawless because that's his nature. His nature is that he's non-changing. He's samye, he's equal to everyone. So if you develop this quality of sameness, of equanimity towards all living entities, you're the same as Brahman. You're the same as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. You're in the same category. And because of that, this verse is saying, jitta sargo, you've conquered the material world. This is how important this quality of sameness is to the process of self-realization. So, essentially this verse says, if you stand in equality, if that's where you live, you're equal in all circumstances, you see beyond the external trappings of every living entity, and you see how they're part of Krishna, Brahman, then you're also situated in Brahman. And you're also flawless like Brahman. This is the implication. Then we can see that this is in action is also the essence of life. If you look at 433, Krishna will say that 433 is about sacrifice in this chapter called Transcendental Knowledge. And so he says, Shreya, Shreyan Dravya Mayad Yajnad Naj. Go ahead. Jnana, jnana, yajna, parantapa. Sarvam karma kilam parta. Gani parasimapyate. So in this verse, look at the translation. Krishna is saying, O chastiser of the enemy, Parantapa, the sacrifice performed in knowledge is better than the mere sacrifice of material possessions. After all, O Sunaputta, all sacrifices of work culminate in transcendental knowledge. So the essence of this in relationship to the conversations on what is sameness means that the transcendentalists take shelter of consciousness, not of matter. And that Krishna is saying here, when you perform some sacrifice, you can offer something like a material item. Like, what could you offer to the Lord? Incense. You could offer incense. Strawberry incense. We used to have spiritual sky. Strawberry, vanilla. Lavender. You can offer incense. You could offer cash. I mean, what is cash anyway? What is it? Paper, basically. Paper and a kind of cheap metal, just imprinted with something saying, we promise to pay you back, even though we didn't have anything. Just a bunch of debt. So it's a material thing you can offer. What else could you offer? Flour you could get somewhere around here. Someone could run out. There's not a lot in the neighborhood, but we could find some to steal. No, I'm just kidding. We wouldn't do it. There are all kinds of things, fruits, flowers. If you just offer those unthinkingly as a ritual without any thought behind it, he says it's not valuable. But if you put your heart into it, if you put your consciousness into it, and when you offer it with love, as Krishna says, patram pushpam palam toyam yumi bhaktya prayachati, then it has some value. So now we find out where this actual value in life comes from and where the summit from, the way that one can remain equal comes from. It's from the level of full consciousness that one offers one's conscious intention to worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And so the sacrifice of knowledge is better, not just dravya, material items. And so if we don't offer our heart and consciousness, then we're really not offering anything. So Krishna's giving us this insight into how he sees the world, what's valuable in it, and says in the Gita, learn to see it the way I see it. Learn to find what's valuable in what I find is valuable. It's in consciousness. And when you find that, then you've found the real wealth in life. And finally, for today's conversation, 520. Na prahrishyet priyam prapya, na vijet prapya cha priyam stira buddhira sambhuto. Brahma vid brahmanistita. And the translation is, a person who neither rejoices upon achieving something pleasant nor laments upon obtaining something unpleasant, who is self-intelligent, who is unbewildered and knows the science of God, is already situated in transcendence. So, again, this idea of not being affected by priya or apriya, that those things, you may get something that seems very nice or something that seems objectionable, but a person who is situated in Brahman isn't concerned one way or the other. Back to the verse, not the translation, but the verse itself. So, na prahrishyet priyam prapya. So, prapya means to get something, and prahrishyet means you don't become overly excited when you achieve. Something that seems favorable to your material condition. And no dvijet prapya cha priyam. Nor do you become udvijet, disappointed, or morose when you get something that you didn't like in the material world. Because stira bhudira sammuto, because your intelligence is not bewildered. Brahmavid brahmanistita. Now listen to this. Brahmavid, this person knows Brahman. a Brahmanistita, and this person is situated in Brahman. This person knows Brahman and is situated in Brahman, who reacts to the world in this way. So this is very telling about equality in the material world, and Krishna's equal, and when we learn to be equal also by connecting with him, by seeing the way he sees, and valuing what he values, then we're situated, we know Brahman, and Brahmanistitaha. And also important here, sthira bhutir. This comes from the intelligence, from the buddhi. And we go to the third chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, 42nd verse. Krishna says, indriyani prayanyahur indriyebhya paramanaha manasastu parabhudir yo buddhi paratastu saha. He said, recognize that the intelligence is higher than the mind. So the mind may say, I like this, I don't like this. Have you ever had that happen? You see something, you say, I like, I don't like. But above that is the intelligence who's the parent in the room, says, no, you have to take it. Like the kid says, I don't want to eat vegetables. I want to eat gummy bears or whatever it is. Are those bona fide? No, they're not bona fide, so it makes it even worse. The mind is like that. It says, I like this, I don't like this, I want this, I don't want that. It's based on some emotion. But the intelligence has to be situated in this Brahman vision and take hold, take charge of the household and say, no, that's not good for you. So he says here, what did we move to the next? 342? Oh, that's all right. You don't have to go there. Go back to 520. So, just in conclusion, after presenting all these facts about self-realization and about how one should conduct oneself in this world as a yogi, this art of remaining equal is called yoga, Krishna says. Then he goes on, Shaknuti Haivaya Shodhum Praksharira Vimokshanat Kama Krodod Bhavambegam Sayukta Sasuki Naraha. So now he says, if a person in this life, Shaknuti Haivaya Shodhum, in this lifetime, might as well go to this next verse, Shaknuti Haivaya Shodhum, forward, march. He says, if in this life, in this world, praksharira vimokshanat, before you're liberated from this body, this material body, if you're able to overcome, could you tell him which verse it is? Shaknoti haivayashodhum. 23, please. Then you're known as a person who is yukta. Yukta means connected to the Supreme. This is yoga. You have the power, shakti, shaknati haivayashodhum. If you have the power to withstand the forces of desire and hatred, kama, krodha, bhavam vegam. These are forces, vegas, like vacha vegam, manasa krodha vegam. If you're able to withstand the forces of desire for the material world, lust, and so forth, and krodha, the anger that you didn't get what you wanted, then you're yukta, you're connected to the Supreme. And sukhinara, not only you're connected, you're a happy human, you're a sukhinara. So this is the formula for actual success. And to understand what the seventh canto in the very beginning is teaching us, and be like Krishna. Krishna's equal, be like him. And Krishna also advocates in the Bhagavad Gita, I'm completely equal everywhere, and in all circumstances, I'm indifferent to the material world. You also be like that. And when you learn to do that, you'll be part of my nature. You'll join with me. So this is very commonsensical. And it's something that people intuit naturally, the sameness of all living entities, as I pointed out from the Constitution of the United States, the fact that there's a higher truth in the material world, of, as Rita Nenemar points out, justice is not an empirically provable item. You can't look at it, but everyone intuits that it is what's the right thing to do or what's the wrong thing to do. And that doesn't make any sense from a materialistic platform, because if we're all just material chemicals, then it makes perfect sense to commit genocide, because it thins out the population so more people can eat. From an evolutionary point of view, justice really doesn't make sense at all. So if you're a complete materialist, you don't subscribe to justice. And if you do, then you're subscribing to a higher truth. And that truth is self-evident. It is self-evident, according to Thomas Jefferson and according to Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita. And to any rational human being who isn't a psychopath, killing people is wrong, killing children is wrong, and so forth. Why is it wrong? Not from a material point of view, but from a metaphysical point of view. Meta means beyond the physical. So Krishna is revealing these truths in the Bhagavad Gita, and the people of San Francisco are awaiting our arrival so that they can receive that one chip of knowledge that fits into the otherwise perfectly functioning machine. Now it's malfunctioning. Hare Krishna. Om Tat Sat. Thank you. Now, we have a couple minutes. We'll take reflections. Hare Krishna. Srivas Pandit Prabhu.
We extend a very warm welcome back to His Grace Vaisheshika Prabhu, without whose presence we are just withering away and our lives were just practically drained. So thank you for just showering your mercy upon us.
Thank you very much, Srivas Pandit Prabhu. It's my only hope that you allow me to come back here. Hare Krishna. And now we'll take a few reflections. Anything that you heard from the monologue or from the verses that we read that stuck in your mind? Okay? 1, 2. Tide goes to the runner in field fly rule.
Hare Krishna Prabhu, this equanimity that you talked about in the class, I was just also wondering how in 12th chapter also, in last few verses, Krishna ends with this quality that you have to see everybody equally. But that seems to be a material quality. But why is it that Krishna is stressing so much? Like, how is it that it's directly related to Krishna? He didn't say that loving me or doing this or doing that, but equanimity.
Well, actually, before you came in, were you listening to the class before you came in? Because I was making the argument that actually it's not a material quality. It can't be. On the material platform, there is no equality. There's no person in here that has, you know, the exact same SAT score, or some people took it, some people didn't, or on any other testable level, materially, you're not going to find equality in this room or anywhere within Mountain View or anywhere in the material world. There's no equality. So equality is not a subject matter of the material world. He's therefore talking about equality that's based on seeing the equal, with equal vision, that all living entities are parts and parcel of Krishna. And obviously, when he speaks the verse Vinaya Sampani, that there are these different living entities, however one sees them the same, one may not treat them the same, even though you see them the same. This is a conundrum for people who don't have the knowledge of Bhagavad Gita, because they try to say that everyone should be equal. Everyone should have equal, but that doesn't work. There are philosophies, you know, in the world, social philosophies, political, societal philosophies that say, do away with all the hierarchy, just have one, but it doesn't work. As we find that it ends up, there's a tyrannical government telling everyone you have to be equal to everybody. So then now you have two tiers, and it becomes even more extreme. It always shakes out in that way. That's why Krishna elsewhere in the Bhagavad Gita talks, Chaturvarnyam Mayashrishtam Guna Karma Vibhagasha. According to the material modes of nature, externally we're all formed according to the modes, and therefore there are different categories of people who are inclined in certain ways. Let them be accommodated according to their propensities so that they can be peaceful on the material level. So when in the 12th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is speaking about the treating people equally and seeing them equally, he's obviously talking about their spiritual nature, not about their material nature. Does that make sense? Yeah. Oh, yes, and Bhamukunda Prabhu, and then Shraddha.
Hare Krishna, Maharaj.
Hare Krishna.
So you made a point that we should try to see how Krishna sees and what we should value, what Krishna values. So one thing I was thinking, Krishna have given every living entity freedom. He don't enforce his anything on a living entity. So even in our life, we see, while in different dealings, we may influence, we may encourage, but we cannot control them. So understanding that Krishna have given the inherent freedom to them, and we value everybody's freedom at the same while dealing in society, helps a lot to reduce our stress, that why people are not acting the way I want.
Yeah, that's a good point. To add nuance to your point, in the Gita, Krishna says that there are regulative principles of freedom that one must follow. So this is an interesting point, because although the living entity has freedom and we honor the freedom of the living entity, when one's in a position of responsibility, for instance, if one's a parent, you have to set boundaries for your children, otherwise they will misuse their freedom. Similarly, when you're a transcendentalist, you have to regularly inform your buddhi, your intelligence, by hearing Bhagavad Gita, so that it can administer the proper type of boundaries for the mind and the senses. Otherwise, they'll misuse their freedom and become more and more implicated in the material world. So without Shastra, we get Shastra. Shastra means that self-imposed boundaries that we learn from the highest authority. We accept there's axiomatic truth that comes from the highest authority. It's in our best interest. It's benevolent voice speaking to us in Shastra. And we accept it. Then we're guided properly. And from the same root word, Shastra comes, which means the sword. And if we don't follow it, we just say, I want to be free to do anything. Then the sword comes out of material nature, and we get punished, and it happens in ways that are astounding. It's so precise, and it's there to remind us that although we have freedom, it has to be taken in a way that is in alignment with Krishna's will. That's our ultimate happiness. Shraddha.
So one of my points was the same as what Balmukunda Prabhu said, and I was thinking that when you're not able to see things, then if you go a little higher, you get from 30,000 feet, you see more of the town than you would see if you're on the ground level. So connecting to Krishna does that. There were two more points. One was, thank you for giving us the missing pages of the U.S. Constitution, that yellow book. And also, in the beginning you had mentioned that the holy name simply enters the ears and it doesn't...
Yeah, that could be your line today. Yeah. Did you know there's a page missing from the U.S. Constitution? It's in here. Here, take this. And what was the second point?
Second one is that the holy name simply enters the heart and doesn't wait for anybody to acquiesce. That was really powerful, you know.
Yes.
Think about
what's that fourth verse from the Rupa Goswami's Namashtakam was Malini. He says that the holy name is yad brahma sakshat krita nishchaya api vinashama yati vinana bhogai. Wait a minute. Go back. Third. Yadabhaso pyujyam kavita bhava dvanta vibhavod drisham tatvam danam api dishati bhakti pranayinim. So this verse says, yada abhaso pyujyam kavita bhava dvanta vibhavod. So the holy name is like this, that he says, even if a person is in dhanam, he's blind to the truth. Tattva andhanam means he's blind to the truth. Drisham, the holy name gives him the sight, vision, to understand the truth, which is bhakti pranayanim. He understands bhakti is a good thing. Just by hearing the holy name, it can awaken that sense of bhakti. And how much of the holy name? Yud abhaso pyujan kavalita bhava dvanta vibhava. It enters into the darkness, and even a dim glimmer, just a little reflection of the holy name, like we're downtown San Francisco and it's bouncing off the walls. Someone's going into Macy's. Does that still exist? Is still a Macy's in the world? It goes that they're walking into Macy's two blocks away, but the holy name's bouncing off the canyon walls of these big buildings, and it happens to enter into somebody's ear. And all they hear is Hare Krishna, one thing. They go in and like, where's that jacket I need to buy for my cousin's brother's sister's friend who lives in Alaska? And otherwise I'll be persona non grata if I don't get it in blue. But they hear Hare Krishna. Don't you hate shopping? I hate it. I stopped doing it many years ago, thanks to Nirukula. One of the great services she did, even during the Christmas time when my family was still alive, I'm an orphan now, but, there was a semblance that, with some participation in holidays and stuff like that. I totally faked it because of her, she'd go get stuff, put it in a box, and it's like, here, give this to such and such, and here you go. It's like, what's in there? What do we give them, anyway, I hate shopping. But if somebody's shopping, they're in that morass, inwardly, outwardly, and they hear Hare Krishna, Yadabhaso. They just hear a dim reflection of the holy name. It goes in their heart. It can awaken this sense of bhakti. It's so powerful. That's why it's recommended in the age of Kali Yuga. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's spiritual master taught him this verse. He said, Harinama, Harinama, Harinama eva kevalam. Kalaunya stevana stevana steva katiranyata. In Kali Yuga, nothing else works, nothing else works, nothing else works, except the chanting of the holy name, chanting the holy name, chanting the holy name. He emphasized it from the Brihat Naradiya Purana. So you have to chant, and you have to chant loud. That's why we also distribute books, because the book will go home with them, it will penetrate their house, their office, and then everyone will have a chance to read it for generations, and the holy name is there within the books. Three minutes. Any other reflections? Yes.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. I like the point that you mentioned in the beginning of the class that while we are in the book distribution, we meet many kinds of people. It reminds me, we were at Palo Alto Arena and happened to meet this lady, and I was just talking about Bhagavad Gita and Krishna. She was persistent, no God exists, and I spent a little bit of time, I felt agitated, but now since you mentioned that you still need to be, treat them equally, so don't get agitated. That's very helpful.
Yeah, and from just from a logical point of view, saying God doesn't exist is a fallacy. It's a logical fallacy. Because if you say God doesn't exist, God's all-knowing, so only He knows everything. So only God would know if there's no God or if there is a God. So to say that God doesn't exist means that you're God. You must be God, because if you are all-knowing enough to say there's no God, then you're God. So saying that I'm an atheist is actually a logical fallacy. If someone says I'm an agnostic, I just don't know, that's another thing. That's you could be sincere and say that, but you'd have to be cynical and have faulty logic to say there is no God. So this the whole premise of there is no God, and then develop a whole civilization based on that is extremely foolhardy, and we're against that. We're trying to fill in the blank so people can understand logically how there is a God, and we're not giving sketchy information. It's very detailed. Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam give very commonsensical, logical, progressive ideas to understand why there is a God, and this is arguably the most important work that's going on in the world. Anyone who's doing this kind of work, explaining about a relationship with God, is doing important work. But those who have the most complete information and are able to deliver it in the most effective ways are having the highest and most impactful effect, that's redundant, on the world. So we'll take one last point. And then what's going to happen, Malini? You know, because you just came from the other wing of the building. You give her the microphone, she'll tell us what's happening next, right after Shraddha brings in something from the internet.
So there's a comment on Facebook and then a text.
There's a comment on Facebook. Yes. Fantastic. Let's hear it.
It's from Rameshwar Prabhu.
From who?
Rameshwar Prabhu, Robert Grant.
The Rameshwar Prabhu?
Yes.
Robert Grant? Oh my God.
Yes.
Well, that's a harbinger of ours that will be successful today. If he's checking in before we all go out on Sankirtan today, then because he was Srila Prabhupada's trusted right-hand man at the BBT who sparked a revolution in big book distribution all over the world. And so the fact that he's checking in means that we're going to have a huge day today.
Somehow or other, this medicine, which has unlimited potency, must be distributed to everyone. The entire society is diseased, and this infinitely potent medicine within Srila Prabhupada's books must be given out as a cure. It must go from door to door and from hand to hand, and it will always endlessly act. Param Vijayate Sri Krishna Sankirtan Ki Jai.
Thank you, Rameshwar Prabhu. And please, everyone, try to take those words to heart. Because there may be other ideas that this isn't so important, maybe we should retire now, we've done enough, and so forth. But actually, our mission is ongoing and eternal to distribute this knowledge. And we just happen to be set up right now in such a way that we have the wherewithal to distribute the knowledge in mass. And we're not actually doing it in mass yet. We're setting ourselves up so that we can. There are people like the Jehovah's Witness and the Mormons who are doing, and the Gideon's Bible people, who are doing much, much bigger than we are. Much, much bigger. Is that okay with you all?
No.
Not really, right? So I think that we should consider whatever little infrastructure we've developed for printing books, tiny, tiny, what we've done so far, and whatever organizational facilities that we have so far to distribute books as the beginning, the small beginning, and to the degree that you've been bestowed with talent and resources and so forth, if you would kindly invest it in developing this infrastructure so that we can increase the number of books that we distribute all over the world and the quality in the way that we present them, and including the way that we're able to follow up after people read them so they have somewhere to go to actually practice what's in them. Please take that as your life. Well, you already am preaching to the choir. Please continue taking this as your life and soul, and think of increasing it as much as possible, because that's where your good fortune lies, in putting your energy into that. There's one last point from the internet.
It's actually a question.
It's a question.
Can we take it?
If I can answer it in one word.
Okay. So this is from Natalie Mataji. Hare Krishna Maharaj, welcome back. Thank you for this dense lecture. I either read this or heard this recently, that intelligence is more about our actions based on knowledge. If this is true, then going off, intelligence becomes bewildered by getting excited over something favorable. Then does that mean it's our actions that confuse our intelligence? That in order to have our intelligence steady, it's dependence on our actions and not so much on our emotions.
Our intelligence must be fortified, as I said earlier, by hearing from the Bhagavad Gita and the Srimad Bhagavatam. If we hear regularly from the Gita, then when we encounter pleasing or displeasing circumstances materially, we'll have the wherewithal to not react immediately. And actually, that non-reactiveness based on my particular mode of nature and the object that I'm observing, my ability to not immediately react to it is the degree to which I've developed my intelligence. So the two things happen simultaneously, but it's based on our connection with the Shastra. In the beginning of devotional service, we have to be fully dependent on Shastra to inform us what to do and what not to do, and we have to have full faith in the Shastra also. Faith means faith in Shastra. And if we have that, and we take full advantage of the Shastra by hearing properly and discussing it and understanding why it's true, then we'll have the wherewithal to not be materially reactive to the various good and bad circumstances that we encounter. That's the best I can do in the time I have now, and thank you very much for the question. Gopremanande Haribo Vanchagobdurusha Kripasanabevacha Patitanam Pavanibhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha.
Natari Armarman.